Good morning. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Toure Reed of Illinois State University. He is in the history department, and you know, if you've read The Jacobin or The New Republic or The Nation, you might have seen his work already. Dr. Reed is also primarily focused on the impact of race and class ideologies on African-American civil rights politics, as well as U.S. public policy from the progressive era through the presidency of Barack Obama. Dr. Reed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Get Out was written and directed by Jordan Peele, and since its release, it has been nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Actor, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Picture. Get Out explores the horror thriller genre through its emotional and intellectual bedrock of post-racial thought when Chris, portrayed by Daniel Kaluuya, meets girlfriend Rose, Allison Williams' parents, in what evolves to be a sort of a modern pseudo-slave auction over his body. And so, going off of that, what were some of the initial themes that you noticed kind of throughout the film?
What I thought was interesting about Get Out is, in some ways, it's a more thought-provoking film than Jordan Peele had envisioned. I absolutely recall the enthusiasm that many viewers had for the film, and I'll say from the start, I thought it was an interesting, and I mean that in a non-loaded way, decision of Peele to take an interracial relationship as a jumping-off point for a horror film. I'm not sure that had ever been done before, and I could appreciate why that would have been a good jumping-off point, because good horror films, like good sci-fi films, often provide social commentary, and the best ones are thought-provoking, and I think Get Out is, if nothing else, thought-provoking. But I think in many ways, as I said from the start, that it's a more interesting film than Jordan Peele consciously constructed, insofar as while many people walk away from the film with the feeling or interpretation that this is an account of whites co-opting black bodies or black culture or however we're phrasing it these days, if you take in the film, the characters in the film and the setting, it's not whites en masse. It's the class of white people that Jordan Peele went to college with at Sarah Lawrence. It is, in some ways, a commentary or a critique of upscale white liberalism rather than a critique of whites in the aggregate and their take on race. Now, again, I should be clear, how I interpret the film is not what Jordan Peele had envisioned. As I understand it, Jordan Peele actually didn't approach the film with the lens of class. He did see it in terms of white and black. But that itself is fascinating, that Peele didn't intend to cast the film in class terms, but instead conflated whiteness with upscale, right?
Sure.
So I think that he was on to something. He certainly touched a nerve. He resonated with a lot of people. But as I said, in many ways, it's a more complicated film than the author had intended.
Yeah, I completely agree. I also think it's interesting how the author's intent is sometimes surpassed when we have these major film releases and the audience reinterprets the film, as it were, especially coming up with fringe theories like Catherine Keener's character. Catherine Keener, who was also in Being John Malkovich, and there's a theory that
and
she
plays... And the 40-year-old virgin.
Yeah, right, and the 40-year-old virgin. But she plays the same character, allegedly, from Being John Malkovich, because that's also sort of a mind trip fraught with anxiety. I think you're right. I think it's something that sort of resonated with all audiences, white, black, all manner of people, all different age barriers. I think it kind of struck a chord. One thing that I noticed immediately about the film was after that very chilling introduction showing the abduction of what appears to be a young African-American man by some unknown assailant, we are introduced to the lead character of the film, Chris, and we're introduced to our protagonist, Chris, through his photography, and it's set to the song of Redbone by Childish Gambino, which has this fantastic quality to it that merges, I think, his identity, and also we see that that Redbone has this foreshadowing through its very plain hook, which is "Stay Woke." And I think that's in the context of this film. Obviously, you know, the term itself, the phrase "Stay Woke," is largely a warning, I would say, to specifically to African Americans and African American interests. But in the context of this film, I think it also has a double meaning, sort of alluding to black consciousness. And throughout the film, we see examples of this, especially when thinking about W.E.B. Du Bois' double consciousness.
No, that makes sense. I probably had not made that connection, or at the very least, if I may have, but since I haven't seen the film in a couple months, it wasn't fresh in my mind. But certainly the film resonated, and I think this is one of the things that had informed Peele's decision to write this film and direct it the way that he did, particularly if one takes in the alternative ending. The film resonated in a moment in which many black Americans were animated by the problems of mass incarceration and police brutality that were literally beaming into our homes on a regular basis, on an interminable stream of incidents of disproportionately black men who were brutalized by police officers. And Peele, in violation, we should say, of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, if not Fourth. And Peele was motivated, I think, in large measure by these ongoing problems that impact black and brown people disproportionately. So the Stay Woke theme makes sense, as you point to, within the film. And I think that was one of the things that made the film such a big hit.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you brought up police brutality, because we're going to talk a little bit more about that later, in addition to the original ending, which also has some undertones of that as well. One other thing I think is sort of interesting is the idea of identity, and that is also a recurring theme throughout the film, which seems to be both the double consciousness and the identity seem to be represented in the film's sunken place, which is this idea that, you know, there's a certain part of you through hypnosis that's achieved through Catherine Keener's character, where essentially you are out of the driver's seat, not an active participant, but rather an audience member who is a captive audience in place of being in control. The idea of the sunken place, as Jordan Peele has talked about in interviews following the film's release, seems to come from a genuine place of being marginalized in society. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's an actual, you know, quote unquote, way out for African Americans in our current society from this place of marginalization?
Yes, I don't think it's an easy path, but I think maybe there's an irony in the formulation from Peele's characterization of it. You know, one of the things that's driving, as you point to, the narrative is a feeling of marginalization that is wrought by whites' co-optation of black identity, right? And not just black identity as something that is commodified, but the souls of black folk. Since you mentioned Du Bois, I'll throw that in.
Sure, yeah.
And I think I understand how that theme would resonate with people in the post-racial era, where we find widespread disillusionment with the promise that President Obama's presidency, you know, offered to fulfill for many people. I will say that I always understood post-racialism was a reactionary fantasy, at least the version of post-racialism that President Obama, you know, was selling, or at least was supposed to represent. But I can appreciate why people who bought it, bought into that notion, and I think Jordan Peele might have been one of them, would have been disillusioned with post-racialism and that false promise by President Obama's second term, if not the middle of the first term. Having said that, I think that the feeling of internal marginalization isn't really the issue. I mean, it is the issue, an issue that Peele is speaking to, but everyone has a double consciousness, right, or a triple consciousness or a quadruple consciousness. We're all complicated people, and complicated people have facets to their personalities. Frankly, W.B. Du Bois stopped using the double consciousness framework around 1906, I believe, partly because the presumptions driving it were, well, racist in the true sense of the word. They presumed a trans-historical black identity or a trans-historical white identity or a trans-historical fill-in-the-blank identity,
sure.
Which is a concept that, frankly, Nazis would be fine with, right? Because it presumes a realness to race.
Right.
And Du Bois became aware of that as he thought these things through and jettisoned it. So the internal struggle, I think, isn't the real issue, even as many people are invested in it. The path forward, I think, comes down to trying to make sense of where black people's issues fit in a broader picture, right? And if you do the math on this, blacks, and this is worth thinking about in the context in particular of the alternative ending of Get Out. If you do the math on this, there's no question that blacks are overrepresented among, let's say, those that are incarcerated. Black Americans are, I think, are about 40%. Roughly, of the inmate population. The other 60% consists largely of whites and Latinos. I believe whites are about 39% of the inmate population, in fact. And what that tells you is that the mechanisms that inform unfreedom that the inmate population is subjected to today,
right,
versus the unfreedom that we would call slavery in the antebellum period, are different. The path, right, because whereas 40% of the inmate population today is black, 100% of the slave population in the antebellum period was black.
Right.
And that means that there's something else at play other than a reductionist racism, even as race is part of the problem, right, or racism is definitely a facet of the problem. Poverty is probably the star of the show when it comes to mass incarceration, when you take in the inmate population holistically. And I would suggest the path forward, the way out of the marginalization, is to take a sober look at what the actual sources of marginalization among blacks are today, and how they overlap with other populations, with the end game of forging coalitions, political coalitions, that can redress issues, the issues that inform or are really fueling mass incarceration. And poverty would be one of the key ones, along with the militarization of law enforcement.
Sure, sure. And I'm glad that you brought up, you know, law enforcement as well as the statistics of prisoners and that inequality ratio of African Americans to, you know, other people in prison today, because that's part of where I was going here, looking at the character of Rod, which is, of course, played by Lil Rel Howery. Rod is in Get Out, the TSA agent, best friend of Chris. And we see Chris's friend, Rod, the TSA agent, as he embodies really the audience. The audience is sort of split between Chris and Rod. Chris being the person who, you know, is a real person and is in potentially a real situation of meeting his white girlfriend's parents for the first time. And yet, despite Rod's infusion of comedy, sort of on the other spectrum of the audience's perception here, we see that when he turns to the police with possible theories for Chris's absence and possible abduction, as part of the system, nothing is done.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is an accurate representation of how the majority of African Americans feel around law enforcement as agents of a systemically flawed institution?
I think the short answer is yes. and, you know, for understandable reasons, many Black Americans, myself included, are raised to be wary of police officers with an understanding that if you're a person of color, that functions in the minds of many in law enforcement and unfortunately as well many in civil society as evidence, or at least an indicator, I should say, that you are a suspect. The presumption that law enforcement would not necessarily work on your behalf, and in fact, maybe even seeking law enforcement's assistance might work against you, is commonplace in Black America, and for good reason. It's also probably commonplace among poor whites, too. I mean, if we think about some of the horrific incidents involving centered on excessive police conduct, it transcends race, right? I mean, the majority of people who are murdered by police officers in 2015, which would be the most recent year that I've looked at statistics for, were white, right? And I think so far every year that's been the case. And Blacks are, you know, far and away overrepresented, no question about that. But there is a broad problem of militarization, I guess, of police action that more and more Americans have acclimated themselves to. And of course, none of that is to deny that racial profiling is a thing. It absolutely is. And I had my own almost unbelievable experience with racial profiling in my own neighborhood as a teenager in New Haven, Connecticut, where I couldn't have looked any different from the suspect that someone at the scene of the crime had identified me positively as, despite the fact that the suspect and I looked absolutely nothing alike, but we were the same race and same sex. And that's all that they knew, and that's all that that law enforcement had shared, ultimately, that dispatch had shared. So it was very clearly a kind of profiling situation that was part of law enforcement's default practices in the mid to late 80s when I was a teenager and hasn't gone away, unfortunately. But nevertheless, there is a complexity to what's going on here that is often lost. And the complexity isn't a denial of the excesses. It comes down to the fact that there are a number of marginalized communities that often enough find themselves, or at least we should say disproportionately find themselves in the crosshairs of police excesses and the excesses of prosecutors and the like as well.
Sure, yeah. And I think this brings us to the end, which, again, spoilers, but also go see this film. If you haven't seen it, please go see it because it's really thought-provoking and, you know, just an interesting piece of film history overall. But we get to the end where Chris has essentially single-handedly destroyed the entire Armitage family, the antagonists of this sort of liberal white utopia. And we see the flashing lights of a cop car pull up. And in this moment, Chris is on top of Allison Williams, who plays Rose, his girlfriend, even though, of course, moments before, it's a life or death kind of fight. And we see him strangling her. I mean, I don't know about everyone, but at least after all of the things have happened, I'm like, yes, kill her. Like, I'm chanting for Chris to, like, kill this person who just doesn't belong. We see that the cop car pulls up and she starts to play up the helpless white woman act in order for Chris to basically be arrested. And what Chris and us as the audience discover is that it's actually Rod, the TSA agent, and he's come to rescue Chris. Peel has said in other interviews that the real police, which was what you were alluding to before when you're talking about the other ending, in the other ending, the real police would have shown up and actually arrested Chris, and then he would go to prison. But Peel changed it because he felt the audience needed a hero. Which ending do you feel supports the thesis of the film, and why?
Well, I will say that I prefer the theatrical ending.
Sure.
Because it just would have been too bleak had Peele gone with the alternative ending, with his original plan.
No, I agree.
and I think the alternative ending was probably more consistent with the mood, the zeitgeist that informed the project, and would have resonated with the audience, of course, but would have been quite a downer. Maybe a bit too much of a downer.
And so you think that levity from Rod, the TSA agent, was needed?
Oh, definitely. I think I won't go so far as to say he was the star of the show, but I do think that the levity definitely helped to keep the mood elevated enough to assist in moving the film forward, right? So it doesn't get bogged down in bleakness. But, you know, just to throw this out here, you mentioned the Armitage family. I really do think that there was something to the depiction of that upscale liberal white family's vision of race that probably was informed by Peele's experience at Sarah Lawrence, which is, I believe, is where he went to college, undergraduate. And that really was what struck me about the film, because their liberalism was, well, essentially racist, right? I mean, that their liberalism really came down to an embrace of black people as the other on some level.
Absolutely.
And an exotic other. And in the film, of course, obviously they wanted to inhabit the body of the exotic other. But nevertheless, the basis for inclusion for that family, racial inclusion, really centered on the presumption that blacks were a conversation piece, were an accessory of some sort, that or an ornament. I think a diversity ornament might be the way to look at it. And that's a phrase that I can't lay claim to, but a colleague of mine had described herself as feeling like a diversity ornament from time to time.
Sure.
And that, I think, often gets lost in how we think about that reality, right, of a kind of liberalism that is officially about inclusion, but ultimately pivots off of the notion that blacks are an unknowable other or an exotic other, is something that really merits reflection on the part of people who identify themselves as liberals or progressives, who maybe unwittingly embrace that view as the basis for inclusion without, again, realizing that it's a fundamentally offensive view because it divests black people of humanity on some level, albeit with the best of intentions in real life, though the worst of intentions in that film. Either way, it's reducing black people to commodities of some sort. And in the film, it's an over-the-top horror show, but it is a reflection on the lived experience of many black Americans who negotiate multiple worlds.
And I think we see that most prominently in the party scene. Obviously, if it's first time watching it, I think you would maybe consider it, if there is such a thing, sort of a benign racism, where where people are interacting with Chris in a way that is not appropriate. I mean, there are numerous examples that are just horrible, horrible things that I'm sure at one point, Jordan Peele has probably heard in his life white people interact with him. But, you know, it's a generational gap. And maybe that's why, you know, I think, again, upon your first viewing of it, you might mistake these older white people as saying, well, they're, you know, they lived in a different time. The way they're addressing Chris is inappropriate, but maybe that's what they're used to. I don't know, but there's, you know, in numerous examples of these older white people coming up to Chris and saying, hey, you know, do you play golf? Chris is like, no, not really. I've only played it one time. Man, I love Tiger Woods. And it's like, that's their in to like, yeah, hey, you're black. You know the things. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that again so many other ways. But also, I think another poignant example is one of the, I think the last person in that montage of people saying horrible things to Chris is this older mustache gentleman who says, yeah, you know, black's in fashion now. And it's one of those things where you can't believe what you just heard, but also it clearly just happened. And I think, again, upon first viewing it, you see Rose's reactions as sort of an embarrassment on behalf of Chris as well. And Chris not really being able to, you know, kind of deal with it in a way that's like, yeah, well, that's, thank you. Like, I don't even know what you would say to that. There are things that don't merit any sort of response. But of course, if it's your second or third or however many times viewing it, you might also see it, I know I did, as like the double meaning of like, you're giving away the thing. Like, stop talking like that. Stop feeling his biceps. Stop making it seem like there's something suspicious.
Right.
I think also Jordan Peele had mentioned before that before the film came out, there's a line that Bradley Whitford says where he's like, I would have voted for Obama for a third term.
Right.
And that is like the quintessential phrase of sort of this liberal critique. And Jordan Peele said that after the movie came out, the new quintessential phrase was, yeah, I've seen Get Out four times. As we close out talking about Get Out, though, Peele said that he drew from inspiration from a number of films, but notably Rosemary's Baby, The Stepford Wives, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, sort of with the shared qualities of looking at, as we've talked about, hidden identities while providing social commentary. What do you think Get Out says in the post-racial America in regards to racism, or at least in the alleged post-racial America?
Well, I mean, I think Get Out is a post-post-racial film, and that it very clearly represents the disillusionment that many black Americans felt, probably beginning with some as early as the Tea Party movement, but with others very clearly in the aftermath of George Zimmerman's acquittal. And so I think it is a reflection on the disappointments, or an expression of the disappointments and frustrations that many black Americans are feeling these days. And in fact, though Peele obviously couldn't have anticipated the election of President Trump, the film probably had that much more impact in the aftermath of the 2016 election than it did before. And that makes sense. At least it makes sense for those people who kinda, sorta, or definitely, whichever, bought into the post-racial framework. I mean, I think a backlash was predictable, and I certainly anticipated a backlash. But back in 2008, I thought a backlash was predictable, and had even said to a number of friends that I kind of feared back in 2008 that the Obama administration would be America's Weimar Republic. Mm. And that proved, I think, to be a little closer to right than I would have liked it to be.
Yeah, a little too close for comfort, right?
Yes, yes.
I did have this one thought that I forgot, and then I remembered. The African-American playwright Leroy Jones, who later I think was known as Amiri Baraka,
Baraka, yeah.
Yeah, Baraka. He wrote a play called The Dutchman, which I had the good fortune of seeing when I was an undergrad at Eastern Illinois University. And I was looking at that recently as well, And that actually seems to have some similarities to Get Out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. How familiar are you with the play?
Not at all. So you will edify me.
Sure. Essentially, it takes place in the play was first done in 1964. But it's something that I think at the time it was a contemporary, and now we sort of see it through the lens. Most people stage it as like a 1964 play, but arguably you could do it in the modern day. Basically, a white woman is on a train of non-segregated passengers. So, you know, it's white people and black people all in the same train car. But this white woman is making these very forward sexual advances towards the African-American protagonist, whose name is Clay in the show. And we see that initially he's not doing anything, and she accuses him of, like, staring at her. But in a way that's sort of flirty, not like an accusatory, you know, like I'm the victim of a crime kind of thing.
Okay.
And slowly but surely they sort of do this dance where he's like, I don't know, maybe you are interested. And then she kind of starts to deconstruct him a little bit and figures out, you know, like, you know, who he's trying to be culturally in society. And also, you know, the fact that, like, she's playing fast and loose with some real weird, you know, I guess, sexual trends at the time. She's, like, really trying to break those barriers. And at a certain point, he's kind of had enough of it. And he just boldly states that racism isn't dead, but you have to act in a certain way in order to destroy racism. And basically he says, you know, if I was to act as insensitive as white people, the very first thing all of us black people would do is just kill the whites. But I don't want to do that. And I don't see that as the core struggle for, like, our independence separate from, you know, white culture. And as he sort of breaks down in this very defiant monologue and then kind of comes back down, she very deliberately stabs him in the stomach and kills him. And then sorry, spoilers. So this whole show is laden with spoilers. So apologies to our audience. But yeah, she kills him and she throws him out of the train car. But all of the other passengers are complicit in this act because she says to all of them to throw him off the train or she's going to start coming after all of them. And what's interesting about the play is that, you know, throughout the play, you know, as they're kind of having these interchanges, people are, you know, they have certain, I mean, nobody else has lines, but they have very real reactions. And, you know, once they're complicit in the act, it seems to pretty much deconstruct the whole thing in the sense that, like, it doesn't matter what race you are when it comes to your mortality. And the end of the play, she tells everyone to get out of the train car. And the next person to come onto the train car after all of that is an unsuspecting second black man. And the conductor, who sort of tips his hat at the white woman, is also black. So I don't know if there's, how do you say his last name again, Baraka?
Yes.
Okay. I just think of the Mortal Kombat character. but yeah, I don't know if Baraka meant to sort of allude to the fact that the conductor actually had a hand in it, but it is very similar to Get Out in the sense that you have a white woman who's sort of persuading these black men as a siren of the sea, if you will, you know, to kind of experience that. And as they're slowly pulled in, that is when she twists the knife. So just a very brief thing where I was thinking, you know, there are some similarities to Get Out in the way that they lure black men and at least and one black woman, as we see in the character of Georgina in Get Out.
Yeah, well, I mean, one would presume that Baraka's narrative would have more of a self-conscious cultural nationalist bent than Jordan Peele's, given the Baraka's politic contrast between that and Peele's background. As I said before, I think Get Out is more complicated than Peele had intended, insofar as though he explicitly, I believe, understood the film as exploring sort of white appropriation of blackness and a kind of monolithic white appropriation of blackness. The depiction is, I think, more of a critique of upscale white liberalism rather than white monolithically. But the fact that Peele, I think, had in no way intended a class analysis, as I understand it, is interesting insofar as it offers some insights into what maybe not only he takes for granted with respect to what whiteness would be, but also I think what many people in the audience would take for granted as to what whiteness would be. And there is a longstanding tendency to think of blackness in monolithic terms as well. So I am, you know, interested in the play as you describe it when compared with Get Out, partly, as I allude to, because of the contrast between Baraka and Peele's presumed politics. So the overlap,
sure,
might be an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, it's definitely a great play. And when I saw it staged, it was also very minimal. Mm. You don't need a lot of things in order to take you there. You know, you have a train sound effect, lights going past, and then a couple seats.
Well, I haven't seen that. I saw Fences not too long ago and despised it.
Oh, really?
So I probably have a critique of Fences, but I wouldn't have a critique of this play not having seen it.
Sure. I'd like to turn now towards Atlanta, which mm-hmm. also has some similar sequences to Get Out, not so much on the brain transplant area,
right,
but definitely that uneasy, I think, white liberalism kind of interacting with African Americans.
Like in episode one.
Like in episode one, and also, in my mind, the Juneteenth episode.
Yes.
That was
great. And that was episode one on steroids.
Yeah, so crazy. So yeah, Atlanta is an FX series created by musician, actor, and soon-to-be Billy Dee Williams impersonator, Daniel Glover, playing Lando Calrissian in the upcoming Star Wars Solo film. For Atlanta, he won two awards, Glover as Outstanding Lead Actor in the Comedy Series, and for Outstanding Directing in the Comedy Series, for the seventh episode, which is actually my personal favorite, called Ban, and that's seen as sort of a parody of a BET crosstalk, sort of public issues and debates type of show. And also, notwithstanding all of that, he is the first African-American director to win, I think, directing in the Comedy Series. So, very historic wins, similar to the historic nominations in the Academy Awards for Get Out. But before we talk mm-hmm. about Ban and some of those other episodes, I just want to talk about the series as a whole. Atlanta takes place, of course, in Atlanta, with Glover's character Ernest, known as Earn, and his quest to provide financially for his girlfriend Vanessa, who's played by Zazie Beetz, and their daughter. And he does this by enterprising his way into his cousin's regional rapper, Paperboy, who is played by Brian Tyree Henry. You know, he tries to get into his entourage. So we had discussed this before when talking about Get Out, but I think one of the most interesting things about this show is the idea that the black experience is not universal for all African Americans, and it definitely isn't in this show either.
Oh, yeah, and in fact, I make a point, as one who's from Atlanta and New Haven, Connecticut. I grew up in both of those cities between the 70s and 80s, I make a point of stressing that references to the black experience are misleading, because what you have is experiences. And so it was very apparent to me as a child, ultimately, because I can also throw into the mix that I kind of grew up in New Orleans, too, or at least I spent my summers there as a kid. And between black Southwest Atlanta, where I grew up principally until through age 13, black New Orleans, where I spent my summers through age 13, and majority black and Puerto Rican New Haven, Connecticut, where I did my high school years and beyond, it was evident to me that the black experience as a phrase really did black people a disservice, because there are multiple experiences. And as you say, one of the things that is very compelling about it, Atlanta, I don't watch Insecure. I've seen a few episodes. My significant other watches Insecure, or at least you've seen the first season. I think the same could be said about Insecure. Going back a ways, this was true of Girlfriends when that was on, and even The Game to a lesser extent, that a number of shows in the 2000s, Atlanta's probably the best of them, have really done good work to offer insights to a broad audience to the variety of black experiences, and normalizing that for both black audiences, I think, and white audiences.
Absolutely. And I think also, you know, we see that in the case of, actually, you could make the argument for both Get Out and Atlanta, the protagonist, Chris in Get Out and Earn in Atlanta, they are black intellectuals who also know the realities of just being in the world that we live in. And they have to deal with, you know, very real topic. Both medias, I think, take it further in their examination of it. You know, they start from a very realistic place and then they kind of exponentially go to somewhere else with it. But I think that both of these characters are very relatable.
Yeah, definitely. And the complexity of those characters humanizes them and black Americans in a way that actually stands out, because there have been so many other vehicles that featured black casts that were reductionist and presented, I think, often enough kind of monolithic views of what black people are. So the complexity of those two characters, both of whom are artistic and introspective, really is very useful for people. It's unfortunate that in the 2000s one could laud a show for presenting, or a show in a few shows, and but a small enough number of shows that I can count, and a film for depicting black people in complicated human ways. But so that's not great, right?
Sure, yeah.
But it does make those shows stand out in a positive way.
Absolutely. And I think, as much as you referenced the first episode as showcasing that white liberalism and sort of ignorance, I think the first episode to me that really stood out was the second episode called Streets on Lock, which really illustrates issues of transgender phobia and relationships and homosexuality and the stigmas attached to that within African-American communities. And we also see mental health and police brutality. We see all of these in this episode.
Oh, yeah. That was a good one.
To give some context for anyone who hasn't seen it, the first episode ends with a shooting. No one is injured in the shooting, but nevertheless, because, you know, we see Brian Tyree Henry, who plays Paperboy, and Glover's Earn in that altercation, they end up going to prison. So when they're in prison, we see that it's more like the DMV, not so much like I think a lot of other representations of prison and jail, where it's the most devastating thing.
But well, and that's because they're in lockup, right?
Right.
And in fact, I think if I recall that episode, Earn was about to go to jail, but Paperboy was bailed out pretty early on by Darius. and the call comes out of the PA towards the end of the workday or whatever, that that they're about to take the guys to jail for the weekend, and Van had bailed Earn out just before. So get a sense of what lockup is like, that episode, because as you allude to, the entire episode takes place in lockup.
Right. I felt like, in a lot of respects, this was sort of the 22-minute version of like an African-American One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I could do that.
Specifically, when we're talking about all these different characters that Earn is encountering while he's in lockup. You know, there's the old guy who's like, yeah, you're not going to last long if you're handing out sandwiches. And we have the sort of the noisy neighbor, I guess, of the man who was caught drinking in public with his friend. And then
who he hadn't seen in 11 or 12 years.
Right. Yeah. It's ambiguous. We don't know who's right.
But we do know that they only had two beers, but they were the big ones.
Yeah, right, yeah. Which in my mind maybe alludes to 40s. I don't know. I'm not sure.
It kind of seemed like it, yeah.
Yeah. But then we also, you know, we see the mentally ill prisoner who drinks the toilet water. And it's funny for a little bit. And then immediately, you know, we see that switch, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that scene incorporated, and also the scene where one of the prisoners is talking to his, quote, ex-girlfriend, who is a transgendered person, and we see the narrative shift within the room. You know, the other prisoners say, that's a man. Like, you're having sex with a man. The prisoner in question, who believes himself to be totally in the right, says, you guys have sex in prison. And the noisy neighbor, as I call him, he says, yeah, but that's prison. You know, like, you do what you have to do in order to survive prison. You were doing this on the outside. And right. So we see there's a lot of intersectionality in the prison to start out. What was your takeaway from this episode?
Well, it was very funny, was the initial takeaway for me. And the guy with the big ones, with the two big beers.
Sure.
I haven't been to Atlanta in a very long time, but I haven't been to Atlanta since the late 1980s. So, but that accent, his accent, absolutely had the ring of verisimilitude, and that was great. It was very much an authentic feel to the discourse there. I thought, with respect to the specific storyline that you're referring to, I thought Donald Glover's intervention in the exchange between the man who was not comfortable with the fact that he had engaged in a same-sex relationship with a trans individual. Glover was seated between that man and his former lover.
Yes, yes.
And Glover's interventions were actually the sort of highbrow informed commentary, a version of the commentary that the guy with the two big beers that you referenced, who made the distinction what one does in prison and what one does in civilian life as a free American citizen. Glover, if I recall correctly, had indicated that to that man that you could do what you want. Sexuality is really a continuum.
Yeah.
In essence, that's not really any different from what the guy with the two, presumably 40s, had said. However, Donald Glover's version of it was values neutral, right? It wasn't judgmental. And whereas the other guy with the 40s had taken a homophobic stance. So I thought that was a smart way to deal with that type of homophobia and related discomfort that tragic young man who was, again, very clearly not comfortable with his sexuality. I thought having Donald Glover intervene the way that he did was quite smart, only because it imposed what we could think of as an inclusive narrative, right? Because it was a non-judgmental and statement of fact about sexuality. It imposed that or injected this analytical framework into that exchange without being heavy-handed, without feeling didactic, and if it had felt didactic, like whatever the functional equivalent would have been on Good Times or House of Pain,
sure.
It would have felt like a TV show. It would have felt like a lesson. The subtlety of Donald Glover's intervention, the realness of it, the humanity of it, may have gone overlooked among some of the viewers, because of the fact that it was not heavy-handed. But it was, I think, an important intervention in that context. And again, buttress the strength of the show insofar as it didn't really feel like a show, a TV show. It felt like a real exchange.
Yeah, the interruptions of that guy saying, "What are you looking at? You know, you think I'm gay?" And him being like, I'm sitting here. Do you want me to move so you can talk to her? Because I'm good with whatever, but, you know, just I watched that, and as much as I didn't want to be in prison, and this doesn't make it seem any more appealing than any other representation, it definitely gave me the impression, like, yeah, if I was in prison, I would probably be acting like Donald Glover in some respects, like that. Like, oh my God, I can't even imagine what it would be to be in that position.
I'd prefer not to be in lockup.
Yeah.
In jail, forget about it. And in prison, oh man.
Yeah.
No thank you. Well, when you go back to the thing that I was referring to with the first episode and why I'd suggested that the Juneteenth episode in some ways was, or at least key elements of the Juneteenth episode were in some ways the first key elements of the first episode on steroids, what I was struck by instantly, and in fact I will concede that initially, though I have been a Donald Glover fan for a long time, initially I was a little circumspect about Atlanta, and a friend of mine nudged me to check it out, and she was right. I was an instant fan from episode one. But the exchange that Donald Glover has, and I think there were two exchanges, that he had with his white friend, in quotes, who worked at the radio station, and the friend's familiarity, we'll say, the white, I will call him professional acquaintance, the white acquaintance's familiarity with Donald Glover, using the N-word to Donald Glover as if he had license to do so, but as framed, using the N-word to Donald Glover because on some level he didn't actually see Donald Glover as really black. And we know that that's what's going on because Donald Glover reacts negatively to the use, but subtly, to the use of that word. And when the white acquaintance goes to his office, Glover comes across a black maintenance worker at the radio station and asks that guy what he would do if that white guy had ever used N-word to him. I think he said, "Has that guy ever used N-word to you?"
Yeah.
And the maintenance worker indicated that, of course, he wouldn't, and if he did, he would, you know, would knock him out. And then later in that episode, when after the radio station plays Paperboy's mixtape, and the white acquaintance comes across Earn and Paperboy and Darius, Earn insists that the white guy tell that anecdote where he had used the N-word previously to Darius and Paperboy, and the white guy self-edited.
Yeah, yeah.
And because, again, I mean, what comes through very clearly is that he sees Donald Glover as not really being black, right? Because he, presumably, because he is not a thug and had gone to Princeton, and in this guy's mind, what it means to be black is reductionist. So that was fascinating. And then, of course, we get variations on that theme throughout the series with, as you point to, the Juneteenth episode being the punch in the guts on that one. I think the episode one is a jab But the Juneteenth episode is essentially the knockout blow.
Absolutely. Well, I think it goes without saying that Donald Glover also doesn't seem like, you know, he's not physically imposing. And we see that throughout that first season, actually,
sure,
that there are other episodes where...
The nightclub.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The nightclub episode, you know, he's waiting to get paid by this promoter who is basically trying to weasel out of the deal. And because Donald Glover himself is not physically imposing,
right,
he, you know, he does not suggest someone that will put up a fight to whatever injustice befalls him. But in both
cases... But it's worth noting that Darius is equally slight.
Yes, and I think it's one of those things. I think Donald Glover's character comes off as even-keeled, even though he's not...
Yeah, or soft, as one might say.
Sure.
In that context.
But I think he's someone that you can reason with.
Yeah.
But he's not going to automatically go straight to fighting. I think
right.
Darius has the cerebral edge. He is just wackadoo crazy. And because he has these very esoteric sort of thoughts, I think people generally just take him on that. And they go, I'm not sure. I mean, he's never put in a situation, I don't think Darius is, where he feels he needs to fight. But it definitely
sure.
is something where, like, I think someone would go, this dude's crazy.
Well,
I'm not going to deal with that.
Paperboy started along the edges of gangsterdom, but they're actually hustlers and not gangsters.
Oh, sure.
Since they skirt along that edge, though, along the periphery, then they project each, at least, you know, within the context of the show, their characters project an edginess that Donald Glover, who's essentially a black hipster, wouldn't project as a guy who's essentially a black hipster. And one could imagine Atlanta being a place, because it is, that has a variety of what are often enough even middle-class black identities, right, or being home to a diversity of black experiences and modes of expression, partly because, I mean, it's a city that, let's say, in contrast to New Haven, Connecticut, that certainly has pockets of poverty and inequality in which blacks are overrepresented. But unlike a lot of the Rust Belt cities, Atlanta being a Sun Belt city, so its economic vistas open up really right around the time that affirmative action is a real thing, right, is a practical thing, which my parents benefited from because they moved to Atlanta in the early 1970s, the same year that the city elected its first black mayor. My dad was a policy analyst and speechwriter for Maynard Jackson, and my mom started off at Coca-Cola as a secretary, and then over the years went from that to executive at Coke. It's a city that absolutely offers a great deal of upward mobility for black Americans. And so since you have that diversity, that real material diversity among black Americans, you'd also have a variety of sort of modes of cultural expression among blacks that are legitimate. I'll say this, my childhood best friend is, and we're the same age almost to the hour. I think he's 3 hours older than me.
Oh, wow.
I kind of grew up in Southwest Atlanta where I grew up. That was in the 70s where one would find much of the black middle class. And by the late 70s, early 80s, my childhood best friend's family was in among the first wave of middle class blacks to move to North Atlanta. And he grew up basically where Donald Glover is from in Atlanta. Sandy Springs, Roswell. And my childhood best friend's mother, who had been a music professor at one of the HBCUs when my dad was in grad school at one of the HBCUs there, his mom had left the professor game and taught at one of the magnet schools, taught music at Douglas High School. And my childhood best friend, I talked to him not too long ago about the fact that he went to high school with Little John, who's about our age. And Little John, he told me, was very much into punk rock when they were in high school. And that very clearly Little John's persona as Little John is just that, right? I mean, but one wouldn't expect in the abstract, if one doesn't have a sense of what Atlanta as a city is or what Black Atlanta as a city was in the 80s, and I think still much of that lingers on because of the economic diversity in the city among Black Americans. If one doesn't have a sense of that, it might be hard to imagine how Lil Jon would have been into punk rock. And certainly I knew when I lived in Atlanta, Black kids who were into that stuff, partly because that's just what MTV was playing. They didn't play Black artists. Back when MTV showed music videos, they only started playing Black artists on a regular basis in the late 80s.
Right. And back when MTV only played music videos. Not that they just played music videos. That was the only thing they showed.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I think they floated out a couple of game shows. Remote Control was probably one of the first shows that technically wasn't about music videos, but I think it centered on music and pop culture. So, yeah, no, that's right.
That segues into what I was going to ask about next. You know, we see one element in Black culture kind of throughout both, which is a small part of Get Out, but I suspect it plays a much larger role in Atlanta, is the Uncle Tom cultural reference. And we see Chris make this assumption about Andre Hayworth, who's played by Lakeith Stanfield, who also plays Darius in Atlanta, before he finds out that he's not exactly all there, you know, that that's actually a white man inhabiting Andre's body, at least mentally. But with Atlanta, since much of the cast is African-American, are there truly Uncle Tom characters throughout Atlanta, or are there just characters who've acclimated better socioeconomically than other African-Americans? Or are these the same thing?
Yeah, I tend not to use Uncle Tom as a framework. I'll self-edit, which I probably shouldn't do on a radio show, but outside of a bar, I tend not to use Uncle Tom as a framework. In terms of its analytical usefulness, I'm not sure that Uncle Tom has a lot of analytical usefulness, though I will confess that I have a great deal of difficulty not using the term when, in a bar, principally, if Booker T. Washington comes up. But apart from Booker T. Washington and a couple other individuals, and again, only in a bar, I tend not to use the term. I don't think it has a lot of usefulness because it's reductionist. And what it often does is it presumes that there is only one way to be Black. And if you understand race and thus what it would mean to be Black as an ascriptive category, as what's in effect an assigned category, rather than something that is inborn, and Nazis understood race as something that was inborn, right? The people who are racists understand race to be something that is, you know, real and intrinsic, then Uncle Tom uses a lot of its value, right? If you understand that being Black is not about how you look at the world, it's how the world looks at you more than anything else, and which is a variation on a theme that W.B. Du Bois had, a variation on a quip that W. Du Bois made a long, long time ago, and was accurate then, and I think that one is accurate now. The other problem with Uncle Tom, it's a variation on the same theme, is that it's reductionist as it pertains to Black politics, too, and presumes, again, that there is a one appropriate kind of political framework. Rather than there being Uncle Toms in that show, I think what you get is complexity. And, you know, the Juneteenth episode is probably the one episode, at least the one that I can think of, where one might see someone, the female lead in that episode, who's married to the white optometrist, would be the closest thing to an Uncle Tom. And I certainly wouldn't perceive her as an Uncle Tom. She's not someone I'd want to be friends with, but she is someone I've known in practical terms.
Sure.
But I think that what was really smart about that episode is that while one could perceive her as an Uncle Tom, if you don't pay attention to the dialogue, particularly the private exchanges that she has with Van, she's an opportunist and is in it for personal gain. And A. Philip Randolph's definition of an Uncle Tom would be something that might be applicable to her, because when he used Uncle Tom, if I recall correctly, he didn't use it as a means of describing people who were racially inauthentic. But for him, because I don't think he embraced that framework, but for him what an Uncle Tom was someone who would sell out the race for personal gain. She might be close to that, but she's not selling out the race. On some level, she's doing what people do in relationships. Her version of it is gross, but that is relationships, if we take seriously the idea that marriage is an institution, well, institutions need people to be institutions, and they need money. And again, in order to be a viable institution, among other things, you have to be solvent. And she very self-consciously picked a mate who provided her the kind of lifestyle that she was comfortable with and, you know, tailored her other expectations, because the most important thing for her, it seems, was the financial stability. And again, that comes through very clearly, obviously, in the exchanges that she has, the private exchanges that she has with Van. And as gross as I found her character as a person,
yeah,
I very much appreciated the complexity and the realness of that character, because I may have chuckled when I said I've known that woman, but I have known her and her male equivalent in life going back to my teenage years, and definitely not my type of individual, not my bag, but there was a realness to that character that merited exploration.
Yeah, I think one line she says it all when she says, you know, he wanted a black wife and I wanted to live in a big house, or something to that effect. And it's very transparent. And I think Van is even sort of taken aback a little bit by the bluntness of, like, her agenda.
I think Van actually says to Earn, do you think I like prostituting myself here, right? I mean, because she was checking herself on the spectrum of what the woman who's married to the white liberal racist ophthalmologist was doing, because she was checking her personal dignity, Van, to make connections, right? To negotiate in this world that she was not comfortable with, this black elite world. And in fact, there's an interesting exchange when Van, I think, is already basically drunk, and she and Earn are having a conversation with three black socialites.
Yeah.
And he gives Van props for being his rock, and the three black socialites, you know, are certainly moved by Earn's affection for Van, which was an act in part, right? And he was being passive aggressive toward her.
Sure.
Though honest, he was still being passive aggressive. And then they extend an opportunity for her to join a black upscale social club. The one that they referenced was Jack and Joe, which actually seems sort of odd because that's for black elite children. They have a baby, but that kid, I think, is a bit young. An infant is a bit young to be in Jack and Joe. But it starts young, right? You got to groom the talented
indoctrinate them
within that
right framework
as early as possible.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
I think what would have been more accurate is they had a space for her in the links or the girlfriends. And that's essentially what the framework was that they were operating with. And Van, if you recall, cashed out at that point. She leaves. That was just a bridge too far for her, it seemed, because it wasn't her. Because she's a hipster, essentially, a black hipster.
Right. And we see, and I guess I'm going back a little bit, I brought up the term Uncle Tom because I think one could make the argument that there are certainly some people who are disingenuous throughout the series in their motives, somewhat like this wife of the optometrist. But also, I think in my mind, just because I saw it again very recently, Lockup, as Paperboy is leaving with Darius, we see a black officer say, "Hey, sure. You're that paper man, right? Paperboy."
Right.
And then he's like, "Hey, man, you know Gucci Mane?" And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I love that rap. It's so great. All right, let's stand back to back for the Insta sluts. And it's just like, oh no, your whole agenda is corrupt from the very start. And it's not even as a clever ruse to like make your lifestyle choices like we see with the wife. It's just very blatantly, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I know that you're famous and I want to get a picture with you for fame's sake. And I think that in a way could be perceived as, at the very least, disingenuous.
It could be, but I didn't take it as disingenuous. And you may recall as well that the officer, when he asked if he knew Gucci Mane, indicated quite enthusiastically that he had locked Gucci Mane up.
That's right.
But what I thought was, the couple of things that I thought would have been intriguing about that exchange, and I'll focus on one, is that there was a complementary relationship in this case between law enforcement and the rapper. Because if you recall, that in every instance, and there are really only two that I can think of, that every publicized instance in which Paperboi is connected to a criminal act, there's a presumption that his star as a rapper is on the rise. First, the shooting. And in fact, when they leave the prison after the exchange that you referenced, they go to the wing place and get the lemon pepper wings wet. But the barkeep at that establishment had given Paperboi props for being a real rapper, doing that 90s thing where you blow him up. And so the shooting elevated Paperboi's status. And then when Paperboi confronts the club owner and smacks him pimp style with the money, the club owner, before he dispatches his lady friend to call the police, says, "That boy is going to be a star," right?
Right.
So there, you know, I thought the police officers, especially if you tease that out over the series, reaction, his enthusiasm for the rapper really wasn't disingenuous, but that they had a kind of symbiotic relationship. Now, that would not apply to the other people in lockup, but as it pertained to the rappers, I would submit that, again, the cop wasn't being disingenuous, but that was a reflection on the what goes into being a successful rapper of a certain sort, right? And this goes back to the early 90s with the genesis of gangster rap, that having a reputation of being a thug confers a certain type of authenticity to consumers, particularly white consumers of rap music, I would argue, that really has long been pivotal. Again, since the 90s, and that would be early 1990s, long been pivotal to the success of various rappers.
Sure, sure. I would definitely agree. And obviously,
and it's like a shark and a pilot fish. I'm fine with seeing the cops as the shark in that context and the rappers being the pilot fish. But I think that's what was coming through there.
I just want to briefly talk about Ban, because it did win an award, and it wasn't initially supposed to be that seventh episode, but because I guess they had some production difficulties, that original plot, whatever it was, fell through. So it's specifically, it's kind of a critique of black culture through, we see the show format of Montague, which is like a public issues and debates kind of show. But we also see that throughout the show, padding the running time is also these very pointed critiques of the commercials in between the show, and also a recorded interview segment with an African-American teenager who is going through this transracial issue. So for Ban, just to give people a sense of what I'm talking about when we talk about these commercials, there's a sequence of Dodge Charger commercials that are progressively building to this really great joke, and the punchline is fantastic. And then we also see a pseudo Miss Cleo sort of infomercial with, if you've seen the show, the first episode, then the Tell a Sandwich guy. He is in the infomercial. He's the Miss Cleo. There's a cartoon cereal advertisement that's similar in vein kind of to the Cocoa Puffs tricks dynamic, where, you know, the cereal is branded as just for kids, and there's a cartoon wolf that's trying to get the cereal. Well, as it progresses, it's framed as a very disturbing dialogue of police brutality. And we also see Arizona Tea, Malt Liquor, and Swisher Sweets commercials that are all, you know, they have that social commentary slant to them. Basically, what their brand is versus what their consumers think it is. Looking at the transracial dilemma, especially, do you feel like that is specifically sort of aping off of real life events like Rachel Dolezal?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the complexity of that issue and the debate surrounding it comes through very nicely in that episode, including some interesting and unexpectedly thoughtful class commentary in Paperboy's reflections on the problems with taking Caitlyn Jenner on as an icon, at least the kind of icon that Caitlyn Jenner has become. So, yeah, they're absolutely playing with fluidity of race and gender in quite thoughtful ways and certainly thought-provoking ways. The commercials, I think, were good fun, too. The ongoing Dodge Charger commercial,
so
though,
great.
As it unfolds, what was great about that, especially, and I viewed that as really very much a commentary on the city of Atlanta,
sure.
Maybe as much as anything else, since this was a man who was, as they would say, stunting, flossing, as we also used to say, but he was presenting an image of prosperity that actually belied his circumstances and was using the car. And the only thing that I think he was able to hold on to in the divorce,
right,
to present this false image. And this has been a line about Atlanta since W.E.B. Du Bois's On the Wings of Atalanta, which when I read as an adult, I thought, and he was critiquing what was then the nascent railroad city of Atlanta and Black Atlanta, maybe more specifically in that era, at the dawn of the 20th century. And I thought, wow, you could say the same thing about Atlanta at the end of the 20th century, the emphasis on the superficiality of life there, right? The emphasis on what we would eventually understand as consumerism among a stratum of Black elites is what Du Bois was getting at in that city at the expense of the nobler things. And anyway, so I really very much appreciated, as you refer to, the arc of the faux Dodge commercial.
I think all of them, all the taglines are especially great. The malt liquor, you're drinking it wrong, because they elevate it to this very high upper class type drink that they're sharing at a masquerade party. Swisher Sweets as, you know, oh, these are great. You know, it gives you that nice taste. And, of course, throughout the entire commercial, people are taking out the tobacco and, you know, basically filling it with weed, which
right.
is...
And there was also the pre-dumped version of them as well, which
right.
had no pretense of tobacco in the shell, was my assumption of what the pre-dumped version would be.
Yeah, yeah. Both that whole episode is great, and especially, I think, looking at the intersectionality, even I think the white doctor who they have on the show to sort of counter Paperboy is saying, you know, how can you not care about these civil liberties for people who are trans or homosexual or whatever when you yourself addressing the transracial character are, you know, so close to these liberties because you're also trying to, you know, come out, as it were. And that guy just saying, no, absolutely not. I am not for that. So those interests that we think because people share common struggles just in the face of adversity as a whole, they don't align.
Yeah, they're only common struggles if you think they're common struggles. And they are. I mean, the civil liberty issues, I mean, I thought this was nice. There would be no meaningful differences between the civil liberties issues between either of those trans figures. And certainly the civil liberties issues as they pertain to the LGBTQ community today versus Black people and other racial minorities, irrespective of whether or not they identify as transracial, are very much the same, at least historically, one would find a great deal of overlap. Even if the mechanisms of oppression or exploitation aren't the same, the civil liberties issues certainly would be.
Right.
And it was great that the way that that episode explores tensions over and the difficulty that some people have empathizing, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And people, as you say, one would expect to empathize.
I just had one last question for you, kind of going back to that ninth episode. We see that sort of as probably the more realistic version of Get Out, where the party really is just a party. No one's trying to dissect your brain. But in a way, they are kind of picking at it a little bit. And we've discussed a lot of the attitudes of the wife of the optometrist, I think, and Van's struggles as a black woman in that environment and what she's willing to and not willing to put up with. I know Donald Glover himself has said that, you know, following that episode, a lot of his white friends were like, well, I'm really torn because I don't think the optometrist, who is very involved and very interested in African-American culture and African culture and just every part of the history, he's not necessarily doing anything wrong. But I also think that, you know, there is a certain air of like, well, you're taking all African-American people and you're placing them in this box as the other.
Right.
And that, I think, is the problematic part of it. But also that they're like Jordan Peele's Get Out, which you so eloquently explained is also sort of a class debate as much as it is like a racial dialogue. We see that here, too. There's very much a concerted effort to make sure that class is represented as well as racial division. And we even see that with the optometrist's African-American wife, who, upon learning that Earn is his cousin's manager, she says, oh, yeah, you do rap. As if to say, that is a very low-class thing to do. And, well, I guess everyone has a thug in
context,
their family.
Right. In that, right, that milieu.
Yeah.
It's not modern jazz.
Right, right. Going on that, I know that you said, even earlier in this episode, that you referenced the optometrist as a racist character. Is it specifically because he's sort of othering African-Americans, or is there more to it than that?
Largely option one. I mean, it's largely the way that he others black Americans. And what one thing that was very cool about how Donald Glover executed that character, or he conceived it and like, is that it's evident that he has the best of intentions. And if intentions trump all else, then he would be a decent guy. But the problem is, and I suspect this is why some of Donald Glover's white friends had problems or were uncomfortable with the character and the critique of, because again, I mean, he's motivated by good intentions as he sees it. Of course, I've never met anyone who has done anything who wasn't motivated by the best of intentions as they saw it, right? And that ends up being the star of the show, because he approaches black people with a kind of missionary's eye.
Yeah.
And it's not just that he others them, it's how he others black people. And again, I could see how this would make some people, particularly people who understand themselves to be liberal or progressive, uncomfortable, because this is a commonplace practice that cuts against the grain of the premise of the show, which, or at least one of the premises, which explores, as we've said from the start, the diversity of black experiences. Craig, I believe is the name of the optometrist, is committed to a reductionist view of black people. And because he presumes that black people essentially share the same struggle and the same brain, he reads black people out of American history to a point. The fact that he was so committed, for example, to Donald Glover going to Africa to know his cultural heritage, and this is, again, a very commonplace framework, offers some clear insights of the ancestry DNA 23andMe variety of the problems of the framework. I don't know about you, but I don't know any white people who have any sense of their family heritage beyond their great-grandparents. And it makes no difference if they came, if their family came here as willful immigrants or displaced refugees who don't exactly have the same choice, right? After about three generations, no one knows anything about their ethnic heritage. And what happens is that they invent fictive ethnic identities, right? So slavery was a system of forced transplantation, absolutely, of blacks from West Africa to the Americas. But in the end, just as with other Americans, hyphenated Americans, it doesn't make sense to presume that black people would have a sense of their quote-unquote cultural heritage beyond about three generations. The mechanisms for transmission of culture come in the form of interaction. And I knew half of my great-grandparents, so I have a sense of my quote-unquote cultural heritage going back to the late 19th century, right, to the dawn of the 20th century when my great-grandparents would have been born. And these would be black people who would have been born at the dawn of the 20th century. But that's as far as it goes. And frankly, with my great-grandparents, and I think this is true, very common for people, they seemed like weirdos to me. And I say this in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way. They were really interesting people. But they were weirdos insofar as they were a good 70 or more years older than me. And I think about 75 or more years older than I was. So they were reading from a completely different cultural playbook than I was, despite our common blackness, despite the fact that we were blood relations. They came up in an era that was far removed from the era that I came up in, right? Because I was born a couple years after the Civil Rights Movement achieved all of its legislative victories, right? The Civil Rights Movement had done everything it was going to do by 1968 legislatively, and I was born in the 1970s. And so I was born after the Civil Rights Movement, when many of the formal barriers, racial barriers for upward mobility for blacks had been brushed aside legally. The formal barriers, informal barriers remain. My great-grandparents grew up in the Jim Crow era. Sure. And one of the worst stretch of it, of the Jim Crow era. And my grandparents, of course, grew up in the Jim Crow era as well, but since they were young people around the Second World War, they had opportunities that their parents didn't have. And my parents, being baby boomers and involved as activists, as people will call them today, my father would hate that, so I'll say organizers. My dad was a poor people's organizer in the last days of the Civil Rights Movement, the late 60s and early 70s.
Sure.
They had opportunities that their parents didn't have, and vice versa. So the experiences that my great-grandparents, half of whom I actually knew, and I had, were very different. The further back in time you go, the more alien your blood relations seem. So Craig's premise really is his good intentions, his related decency, as one might see it, notwithstanding. Craig's premise is actually truly racist, because there's no reason to presume that blacks, the Donald Glover's cultural heritage, really extends to Africa the way that Craig describes cultural heritage, right?
Yeah.
And again, the way that he describes it. There's no way that Donald Glover or any other black person would know anything about West Africa in the genes, any more than Irish Americans know anything about Ireland in the genes. And if you learn about that stuff, if you're interested, it's a good thing to learn about. If you're not, it's not a bad thing to not be interested, because it doesn't have a direct bearing on your life anyway. But if you learn about it, that doesn't mean that you've plugged into the culture either, because in order to plug into the culture, you'd have to be immersed in it. And certainly the culture of your ancestors more than 100 years ago would be profoundly different from people in that same region where your ancestors hailed from today, because culture is dynamic and it's always changing. So again, I mean, Craig, the optometrist, really is motivated with the best of intentions, like any missionary or anybody with maybe in this case a kind of massa complex might be one way to frame what was going on with him.
Sure.
And there was a creepiness, though, to his decency and good intentions because of how he otherizes black people in a pluralist way.
And as I say, it goes just to the edge of Get Out, I think.
Yeah.
If Get Out was done in a way where maybe people really were hypnotized, I think
right.
this is as close as you could get to it without cutting out people's brains. That's where I think that scene eventually maybe could have led, but I also think it's interesting that in this case, even though, of course, Craig knows so much about the culture, that's all he wants to talk about, and he presumes that is all that Donald Glover wants to talk about because, of course, he is black. And I don't know how often this happens that you are talking to someone of another race and all you do is otherize them and talk about their race, and they are very happy to talk about all the things about their race. I think after a little while, it probably gets old. And I think especially when you consider the historical, I don't know, the historical wounds and setbacks, but also progress between
sure.
white people and black people in America, specifically our storied history, that is not something that I would willingly engage in with another
sure.
African-American person unless they initiated it.
Sure, sure. No, and that would make sense because anything else would be presumptuous. And in the character, in the optometrist worldview, it's not inappropriate to broach such topics in that way because black people essentially share the same brain. I would want to add one thing about, you know, building off your astute observation about that party functioning as the realistic depiction of Get Out. And they're both horrible, right? I mean, they're both horror shows. Of one sort or another. But what's even better about that, the depiction in Atlanta, than when compared with Get Out, is Craig, certainly the optometrist, gives you the Get Out comparison. But the black characters in that episode, with the exception of Van and Earn, are all social climbers, too. Right? And in many ways, they're not any better than the optometrist. Most of those people are pretty awful insofar as they're all really quite shallow.
Yeah.
And invested in knowing people who they imagine can do something for them. And certainly Van's mentor had made clear that the point of that party was to connect her to other people who would have been generally black, right? I mean, the optometrist, who's a standout character, obviously, because I love to hate him.
Sure.
That's the only reason I remember his name. It was, in many ways, from my vantage point, a kind of despicable guy with the best of intentions who I've also known many versions of over the years. But the various black characters were really, on the whole, objectionable as well because their social relations all pivoted off of what people in their universe could do for them. They didn't have human relationships with people, right? I mean, it wasn't like the relationship that Van and Earn have,
right,
which is a human relationship. They like each other. And while their romantic relationship is very complicated and probably not terribly satisfying in many ways, they have a real human connection with complicated love and sincere affinity or like for each other. None of the other people at that party seemed to have those kinds of relationships. Everyone was some sort of ornament on the arm or vehicle for networking on a route to upward mobility in some way or another. And the fact that most of those characters were black, I think, was really useful because it highlighted, again, the diversity of black experiences, obviously. And it was a pretty realistic depiction of that world. But it also highlighted the fact that black people don't necessarily have real connections to each other, any more than white people necessarily have real human connections to each other, that blackness is not enough of a basis to have real friendships and affinity for people, because there are black social climbers out there, too, who are only invested in knowing other people who can do for them. And that's why it was so striking that Van walked away, I would say, when the three black socialites had invited her to join Jack and Jill, and why that was a bridge too far for her at that moment. And she was forced to confront the reality of what it meant to put her values, her hipster human values, aside for personal gain. How much of her soul she was going to have to mortgage off, you know, who she was, that she was going to have to mortgage off, became apparent to her in that moment.
We're already in spoiler territory. So they leave the party with no bids on new jobs for Van and probably a less than stellar introduction to Earn after saying, "This is dumb. That guy's dumb. Everything is dumb. This place is dumb. I'm done. I'm done with this." Once again, talking with Dr. Toure Reed, want to thank him so much for coming on the show and discussing with me all the things about Get Out in Atlanta. I don't know any person in my life right now that's as jazzed about either of these things as I am, so I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. I feel bad for talking your ear off about certain subplots and the like, but that was the charge, right? That's what I was supposed to do.
That's it.
I hope.
That was your job, yeah. You nailed it, man.
Cool.
Just to mention to listeners as well, Get Out is going to be at the Academy Awards. They're nominated for 4 different Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Actor. And also Atlanta already won 2 awards, and the second season comes out March 1st. Thanks again to Dr. Reed. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Had a great time.